Thank you. Bruno Monteyne from Bernstein. Two questions related to e-commerce for me. When can you expect a double ROIC on your online food business as well? Is it in the foreseeable next few years? The second one is, for your US business, do you really see the online food as a way of growing your market share or largely replacing, cannibalizing your existing stores? And the third one is, how does the e-commerce growth really in the US again impact your store profitability and volumes? Is it a separate channel you can grow separately, or do you really think the store economics separate from e-commerce are going to be downgraded by that?
Take the return question.
Yep.
We talked about return on investment from Ball being attractive, and it can be attractive on pretty thin margins. And I think we do have to think differently in the future about the different KPIs we look at, because you know, our e-commerce businesses, although we talk about the capital we invest in them, have less capital invested. And therefore, with Bol on a pretty thin margin, we can deliver a return on capital pretty close to the company average return on capital. I wouldn't get into forecasting food as delivering a 10-15% return on capital in the near future, because as you've seen, we have to make some considerable investments in terms of food online. Those investments, when we make smaller minimum order quantities, when we go to same day, those are all investments, which means the movement of food online into profitability is a little bit more difficult to predict. But it does help in terms of market share. I'll leave that for Kevin to talk about. But in terms of how we look at the store, traditionally we've looked at online as a separate channel, and we've looked at the P&L as a separate channel. And I think that's still a good way to look at it. But we also look at it more and more as a part of an omni-channel experience, something we have to do, and as almost a service within the store, the same as we look at some of the service counters, which don't in themselves make money. But where we have, for example, very strong online business in stores at Hannaford, for example, the profitability of the overall Hannaford business has continued to grow, and it's continued to grow because we've been gaining share. But I think that answers a little bit the question about share gains as well.
I think that's right, Jeff. I mean, from an omni-channel perspective, I hope we made this clear today. We look at the total share of wallet, which is a combination of store and online. And we also feel that by doing so, we can, across our network, gain share with those customers. And what Wouter also already said, there is no choice. You might lose customers when you don't have that optionality. So that's for overall for the group, our view that we gain share in an omni-channel perspective. But maybe, Kevin, have you something to add there to that item for the US?
No, I think that's right. I think that the, I think someone said here, I think Walter said that, we can't afford to lose the customers. It's just too expensive to try and get them back. And so our whole design here is to be able to build the omni-channel and then build all of our integrated commercial plans that way. So the way we think about commercial plans historically have kind of been, you know, the commerce part kind of sat over here and then you ran your stores. That's changing dramatically. And so we're integrating all of that today in terms of what we're doing. As we stand the commerce up more directly and we start generating more business, we will have some of that business come from the brick and mortar, we're certain of that, but we believe we'll also generate business that's beyond that. And so we can continue to pick up additional share through doing that. In our example that was used with Mike, what we actually found there was the stores that had Hannaford to go. Actually, if you took out the click and collect sales, the overall comps were actually better than control. And so there's also a whole kind of vibrance to that. Now, in their case, they were a first mover into the market as well. But as we look at the omni-channel, we really think that we will get that ability to grow share, particularly as we differentiate how we're bringing it to market.
Walter, for Europe and the Netherlands, is there?
No, I think it's, sorry. No, I think it's more the same. And I also see it, we have stores where you see there's pressure, but then we reduce cost. Then we use also like self-scan, and we use to remodel the stores and see if there can still be kind of viable. So I think you have to look at it from an umbrella point of view, from an omni-channel point of view, and grow the total basket. And that's, I think, the best answer.
We also talked about a little bit, we talked about media monetization and revenue streams. I think JJ referred to this. Also, our CPG donors look at an omni-channel total program for this. So I think everybody is seeing that same type of development with the total share of stomach.
So linked to that last point, you do see over time your stores adjusting, like you said, in Europe, maybe downscaling and resizing when the need arises.
Well, I mean, I'd say if you look at the Netherlands, we haven't really changed our square footage in the Netherlands. In fact, we've still been adding square feet. So certainly center store might get a bit smaller, but we build up our fresh offer around the store.
The stores are not getting smaller. Actually, the pressure on the store, like the sales per square meter, is very high. I mean, it's one of the highest in Europe that we have. So actually changing the composition of the offering in the store, that is the trick. So we're not reducing the stores, but we are rearranging the stores.
Shall we swing to the east wing of the room?
Yeah.
If there's a question on the east wing. Yeah, Xavier.
Xavier Le Menet from Bank of America. One question, actually. You talk about inorganic growth, but you also have a net debt on EBITDA target, which is 2x. So is the net debt an input or an output? How you look at that? That would be the first question.
Yeah, no. When it comes to any inorganic growth, any M&A activity, we don't look at the net debt to EBITDA target is an ongoing business as usual target. But obviously, we have significant headroom within our credit metrics to deal with any M&A opportunities. And we would expect then we return back to a 2x over time, not necessarily keep to that within the constraints for M&A. Is that clear?
Yes. Yeah.
Headroom as in debt capacity. That's
what as in leverage capacity.
And just to follow up, you used to talk about bolt-on acquisition rather than big acquisitions. So is this still the case today?
Yeah, we shared with you pretty clear how we look at. We look at in-market and adjacent geographies where we would like to invest. The second thing is that we also believe that our present strategy of an omni-channel strategy, as we present this to you today, will create great value for our stakeholders. So those are the two elements we look at. At the same time, when a mid-sized or slightly bigger than a fill-in acquisition comes to the table, and of course we'll look at this, but we always did in our 150 years of existence.
Okay. Last one, if I may, just how does it work with people and the different banner? Because it's, for me, still a bit fizzy about who is doing what, actually. So if you've got a micromanagement fulfillment center, who is owning that? Is it people, managed by people? Is it
we have a very clear structure. Thank you for the question. If it has not been clear, Kevin.
I couldn't understand exactly what you're saying.
The structure of who is now running Peapod and who is now running the micro fulfillment center, okay. What is the responsibility in the total PDL for the various units? That was the question, right?
Yes, exactly. I'm including the click and
So the PDL.
We have a clear answer, by the way. So.
The PDL organization is run by JJ Fleeman, who's right here in the front. And JJ has a team that has digital in it, it has e-commerce in it. It has operations in it. It has Peapod in it as a brand. So it has all of the services that we need to have in order to provide services to the brands. And it also has an IT function where it can build the domain that he was talking about today. The runtime of the domain is actually run in our traditional IT, not all of it, but a lot of it's run in the traditional IT data centers. But what happens then is that they build these services and the brands choose to use them. And so we're building that new stack, and the PDL team is the team where we can, again, build that scale, the competency, the capability, and the partnerships. We also have one I forgot was new business development that's in that team also. And so as we look at partnerships and we look at a lot of different types of opportunities there, we facilitate those through that group.
So a lot of innovation, e-commerce and digital shared services, if you will, are run under JJ's responsibility and will be shared with all the brands. And Peapod, as an e-commerce brand, is also within JJ's responsibility and will be run in the future by Selma. We referred to her a couple of times, being the leader coming over from the Dutch market to lead the Peapod brand here. But JJ is Peapod Digital Labs president.
And the change that you'll see, so Peapod is our .com company that operates out of Chicago. and it's in the Midwest. If you look at the remainder, we have Peapod in the marketplaces today, and they're affiliated with the brands. So there's Peapod in the Stop and Shop area and so on. As we move to the future, what we'll end up with is Stop and Shop powered by Peapod. So the brand will become the predominant carrier, and Peapod will become the enabler. So that's how we're looking at bringing that forward in the near term. Okay?
We swing to the West Wing.
Just two follow-ups on the direction e-com is taking in the U.S. We see that in Europe, from one country to another, you have different business models depending on the density of population, of the size of the cities, etc. You spoke a lot of micro local markets in the U.S. We see competitors pushing different solutions in the U.S. between drive-throughs, home delivery, etc. Do you think for each geography you could have some different solutions, and that there's no one unique solution in the U.S.? And in your businesses, will you have very different organizations in metro areas versus more rural areas? So that's question number one. And maybe just to be sure on Peapod, because I had the same question as Xavier, just to understand how Peapod is going from a home delivery organization to helping the different brands and networks. So will Peapod be responsible for delivery at home for the different brands? Is it like that we should understand it?
Okay.
What will Peapod exactly do? I'm not sure to completely okay. understand.
I will direct the second question to you, JJ. You're anyhow front row here. The Peapod question, because you're running it anyhow. On the first question, what kind of business models or multiple speed models are we going to use in the various job? I think we have the flexibility soon to have the various models under one roof. So, and that's not different for the capital of Bucharest in Romania and the regions of Romania versus Boston and more upper Massachusetts for that reason. I think we'll find the right multi-speed model in all the regions where we operate, depending on also what customers want. Mike Vale is operating a very successful Hannover to go in the state of Maine. And those people are extremely happy with a pickup, click and collect service, and have a big basket with all the assortments in, fresh and these kind of things supported by the brand Hannover. So, but that might be not enough for downtown Boston because customers expect a different type of solution. Now, and that's exactly what we can do. JJ mentioned multi-speed. We had many different fulfillment models, with micro fulfillment centers, home shot centers, and then DC. And I think that's exactly what we have in mind to do, to have the right fulfillment model based on the customer's needs and to make, in the end, the best customer proposition at the best cost.
We also in the U.S. we're looking at, I mentioned the heirloom market that we're doing in Philadelphia. That's a very small urban market. For some of you that remember, we used to have the Beef Fresh markets. We still have a few of those, and those are Stop and Shop prototypes now that we're working on for small store. Mike is working up in at the Hannaford operation on small stores. And so what we're doing is we're trying to also look at other configurations that we could use, particularly in the urban areas where we could go in and then augment that with the omni-channel fulfillment around it. And so you'll see that in the heirloom market where there's actually a pickup position in the store. You can order from store. There's a lot of things that you can do in order to do a full shop while you come into the store and really think about that store as more of a fresh store. And so we're looking at a lot of different configurations around how to really win in the local marketplace and grow that share. And those would be ways that we add on to that as well. But it will be a multi-speed market. There will be different configurations in different neighborhoods. In a rural area, it might be only click and collect. Where you get into an urban area, it might be one-hour delivery, same-day delivery, click and collect. It could be a combination of things, or we might be fulfilling more from automation and last-mile options. So a lot of that kind of activity we've looked at in terms of how we're doing it, and that's where JJ also talked today about 65% of customers will have same-day click and collect and so on. In the combined and in the urban areas, it will be more than that. So.
JJ, the second question, have you got, did you grab a phone already or a microphone? Okay, yeah, you got a mic already.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. So thank you for your question. So back in the summer, when we started to put together Peapod Digital Labs, what we first did is took a look at all of our digital and e-commerce capabilities from all over the U.S. So Peapod technology, web development, mobile development, product development, all the IT solution around our loyalty programs, which I think is the gentleman's question over here, all of our loyalty development, all of our campaign management, all the things that we would do to run a digital e-commerce business inside of the U.S. is now into one integrated experience at Peapod Digital Labs. And so Peapod Digital Labs provides those services to all of the brands in the U.S., leveraging all the assets that we currently had at Delhaize, Ahold, Peapod, all combined into one entity now. As we think about rolling that forward, we're taking the foundation of Peapod's technology. We've made large investments in that technology to create the integrated experience that we talked about today. That will be the platform that powers all the digital and e-commerce for the U.S. My team there of data scientists, advanced analytics, all the folks running campaign managements, so forth and so on, will provide those services to the brands. So the brands can focus on that local engagement, and we can run all the systems and processes for them as we move into the future. We're also bolstering, though, new capabilities, right? We had a lot of data science already, a lot of good product development already. We're making big investments in those areas so that we're smarter and that we are more productive in the future. As for Peapod, we'll continue to take that brand, a very strong brand in the U.S., we'll run it as a pure.com market in the Chicago market, and we'll take those same capabilities that we're providing for other brick-and-mortar brands. We're going to enhance that experience in Chicago to bolster it in the Chicago market and maybe other markets to come. And then finally, we'll continue to leverage Peapod as a delivery vehicle and brand that really supports the brands here at ADUSA today, and we'll figure out how to look at that going forward. In addition to that, we'll partner with others from a delivery perspective. So hopefully that's a little more clear on how we plan on doing this. And we really do believe that bringing this together as one centralized team, that we can really produce an outstanding result as we move forward.
Take some other questions. Go down to this.
Thank you. Nick Coulter from Citi. Three quick ones, if I may. Quantitative, if possible. Firstly, Jeff, on CapEx, is it possible to break out the CapEx going to online and e-commerce? I know you gave an incremental figure overall, but it would be helpful to know the split. That's the first one. Thank you.
No. I don't have the number off the top of my head. Most of our CapEx is still going into our stores.
Yeah.
And the whole point of e-commerce is it's relatively CapEx light.
Yeah.
For sure, we announced we're building a new Ball distribution center, 200 plus million.
Yeah.
We will be spending money in the US on the fulfillment, but also on the pickup points.
Right.
But I think if I had to pull a number out, you know, I'm thinking it's something like probably something in the region of 400 million is online. The majority of our CapEx is still going into stores. Stores at the end of the day are more capital intensive. And, you know, as I mentioned at bold.com, a thin margin can make a high return on capital. And if we get the thin margin at food, we'll also get a high return on capital. But we have to get to the thin margin on food. Currently, it's still, obviously, if you isolate online, it's still loss making.
Thank you. That's helpful. Then, secondly, for JJ on that 145 kind of quasi UPH figure, is that a blended outbound pick rate between the automated facility and the store, or does it include inbound? Just to give us a better sense of the economics there.
You're referring to the micro fulfillment?
Yep. Yeah, the 145.
Yep. Yeah, that's all in productivity number.
So that's inbound and outbound. Are you able to give any kind of indication of kind of pick rates?
No, you can you can ask this afternoon if you're going up there, because there'll be some people there, so they'll be able to answer that question in detail.
But it's an all-in pick rate, you can imagine this is a pilot for us, so it's a little bit too early now to give you all the economics. When we not have even started, the machine is going to roll in January of next year.
No, I'll ask those questions. Obviously, you think it's a winner, so I'm just interested to understand.
The winner is not necessarily the winner only in productivity of the pick rates. It's the winner in the combination of the pick rates and the last mile.
Yeah.
And if you're closer with your micro-fulfillment center to your customers, then the last mile is of a very different advantageous economy. So that combination is what we believe in, apart from a lower capex and faster building time, fitting in our own assets already. We have those locations already in most of the cases. And then coming with your micro, close to your customers, and the sum of capex and these kind of things, and the last mile, plus your reaction time, because that enables you to be much faster with same day or a couple of hours reaction time towards your customers. That is, you should see all those those elements in the combination.
Thank you, that's helpful. Then a quick one to Mark, if I may, on the Stop and Shop. I think you gave some pro forma sales figures in the bottom right-hand slide of the
The bandwidth of the sales numbers.
So those are targeted, I guess, the pro forma numbers in terms of what you expect. Is it just a sales uplift? Presumably you're also looking for some sort of gross margin uplift at the same time, because you're also putting in some more labor. I think I saw a figure of 7% more labor. So it would just be helpful to get an understanding of the dynamics of the P&L that will deliver the expected return for the Stop and Shop.
Let me take that. We do see the sales uplift being a key driver, but there is, and Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, a margin benefit which offsets some of the labor as we've changed the mix in the store. So it's a little bit of both, and when we look at the economics of it, obviously that delivers a good return on capital. I mean, that's the fundamental of the investment profile.
But just to be clear, there's a sales and a margin driver, effectively.
There is a margin element to it, which, as you say, we're putting more labor into the stores, so the gross margin element to that also covers some of that investment in labor.
You'll see there's a big investment in produce and the whole fresh category, so that, of course, has a positive margin mix.
Great. Thank you very much.
We go to the left, yes.
Fabienne Caron, Kepler Cheuvreux. I've got three questions. The first one on Stop and Shop. Do you expect the price investment to go hand in hand with the remodeling, or do you expect to do price investment across all the banner first? Second question on online. The growth that you're looking for, will it come mainly from Peapod and from Click and Collect? And then still on Peapod, I would be interesting to know in percentage terms how much of the customers of Stop and Shop and Giant are today Peapod customers, and how do you expect these percentages to change?
Well, we're not breaking out the growth between Peapod and Click and Collect. I mean, as we look to the omnichannel world, you know, as you know, our growth rates at Peapod and over the last 3 or 4 years haven't been good enough, around 10%. We're confident we can accelerate to a higher growth rate, 20%, moving to 30%. But I wouldn't get into breaking out how much of that is Peapod, how much of that is Click and Collect. We see the omnichannel offering Click and Collect, offering same day, all of those areas are going to contribute to the growth rates going forward. What was the first question, sorry?
Pricing.
Price investment.
The first question was if with the Stop and Shop remodelings, it goes along with the price investment per wave or for the total brand. That's how I understood the question. Yeah. Evan, maybe?
Do we need to?
No, it comes a little quicker than the capital. It doesn't take 4 or 5 years to put the price investments in, but it does go in waves. And I think most of the price investments that we currently envisage, but as we test the different pricing options that we're looking at in terms of the rollouts, but certainly the price investments will be over the next 18 months, 24 months, versus the capital, which will be done over the next...
There's a parallel towards our easy, fresh, and affordable strategy, where we test in those markets high, middle, and low capex, and we also test pricing as well, which has been done way before at Food Lion already. And here, Mark said that we test a few models, what is going to work best. And this we check against a control group in the same region, so I think we can get a lot of knowledge. And then the next wave, we know more about these kind of things on the capex and the price investment levels. In Connecticut and Hartford, we combined the remodelings together with a price investment where we felt necessary, but in different models.
And my question on the percentage of Stop and Shop and Giant customers that are Peapod customer.
JJ, do you know the top of your head?
No, it's pretty small, and that's the issue. It's too small, and that's what we're looking to grow. At the moment, it's a pretty small percentage. If you want to look at what percentage of Stop and Shop customers
overlap with Peapod, it's too small at the moment. And that's the whole point of the omnichannel strategy.
Yeah, we think there's a real opportunity there in terms of what's possible for us as we bring in all of the integrated that JJ talked about earlier today. And on the pricing, that also goes hand in hand with assortments and that, because we're resetting assortments as well. So we have a lot of tests going on in order to get that value proposition identified correctly. And once we're comfortable with that, then you'll start to see it roll out.
And there's a lot of evidence from the Dutch market. If you make an Albert Heijn brand omni-channel store and an online proposition, if you connect that brand, the same promise, the same assortment, the same pricing, there's a big opportunity. And with Stop and Shop or with Giant or with Food Lion or with Hannaford, I think we see that opportunity. You have this omni-channel brand where people say, this is my brand, and I think that is different than we did it before.
Okay.
Shall I? Yeah. Thank you. It's James Grzinic from Jefferies. I had a couple. The first one is, you invested quite significantly in the Peapod price offering some time ago. I would be interested in understanding what the learnings out of that process were. And also, does the 10 becoming 20 becoming 30 just in terms of slope of growth just reflects the convenience element? Or are you willing to put investment in terms of investment into the service offering at Peapod in order to back that? And my last question was about monetizing data. Your peer here in the US has talked about how much money they can make out of that process. I felt it was a bit of an afterthought for you here today on that dynamic. Yeah, JJ talked about it a few times, but you didn't come up with a big, bold number. Can you perhaps address that as well?
Jeff takes media monetization, then you take Peapod on the element of price investments.
Media monetization we've been working at for probably 5 years. We've had a team dedicated to it, and we've been building our income from that over time. We haven't given you a big number, because I think it's part of an integrated approach to how we look at our P&L. We could throw out some big numbers that can't be verified. Our stores don't depend on it. But it's a very important income stream. And it's not small numbers today. It's quite significant numbers. It's very much not an afterthought. As I said, we've been building that team out. That team has been in place.
Five years.
5 years.
That's correct.
Working both in the Netherlands and in the US on both online media monetization, working with partners, working with data, and also working in stores in terms of how we can monetize advertising in stores, for example.
Also, on community sharing technique, sharing technology, best practice. On the other topic of your second question on Peapod, talking about the 20-30%. Think e-commerce total US, where Peapod is one brand and the other brands are fueled by Peapod backbone technology. If you then consider the multi-speed, the multiple speed type of modeling, the 65% reachable in 2020 with same day, there must be enormous potential. So we now give you a number where we're pretty sure that we can hit that number. Let's see how that develops over the 1.5-2 years. If you might have more ambition or more reality there. Peapod to price investment, JJ, what did it do?
Yeah, so thank you for the question. So as you know, we've been working on making strategic price investments at Peapod, primarily on the items that matter most. And so as we take a look at our brick and mortar markets, along with our digital markets, those products aren't identical, but they're similar. As we've seen those investments take place, we've seen volume increases. Probably what we're seeing that's probably more attractive is our best customers' performance year over year is performing better at 5-7% over those previous. And so as you know, in an e-commerce world, the more and more your best customers are spending more with you, the better. The other thing that we've learned, though, is the application of some of our subscription models inside of that as well. And so as we've seen that subscription model take off in addition to those price investments, we've seen a 30% uplift in subscription, and there too we're seeing those year-over-year best customers continue to improve. And as we look at overall movement there and penetration, we're seeing an average spend of about 12-15% more in those that participate in the subscription model along with price.
Okay. I don't know how we're going to get through all of this. We'll go to the back.
In the far corner, yeah.
Great, thank you. Greg Badish, Canyon, U.S. Food Retail and Restaurants at Citi. I'm colleagues with Nick Coulter. Just two or three questions. So first, could you talk about your various initiatives that you discussed today, as it relates to competing with the discounters and also your pricing strategy relative to your large competitors like Walmart? And then also, maybe a little color on what you've been seeing from Amazon and Whole Foods in your U.S. markets.
Pricing strategy, I think we were pretty clear. If you look where we compete with a Walmart, for example, Food Lion, a Giant Foods, we're generally matching on image items. And in Food Lion's case, that's over 2,000 image items.
Two and a half thousand. Yeah.
And versus the full store, we're running at around 110. If you come up north to Stop and Shop, where Walmart has a very small market share, is not a significant player in this market. We are a mid-priced supermarket operator, so in between a ShopRite and a Shaw's, or a Market Basket and a Shaw's, Acme being higher priced, Shaw's being higher priced. And we intend, through our pricing strategy, to get closer to the price leader in each of the markets that we operate in. But it's a very lots of different pricing zones in the Northeast. If you do want to compare versus a Walmart, if you can find one in the Northeast, you know, I think on a total store basis, we're probably running at a mid-teens differential versus the 10% differential that we see further south.
So where we see Walmart image items, roughly one or two index, wall-to-wall, roughly 10% off. That's what we communicated before. We have been very consistent over the time in those geographies where these type of competitive sets matter. And then we had also a newcomer from Germany in the discount channel where a lot of people were extremely afraid about and excited about. I think we did a very good job there, and we competed very well in those markets. And that's the space where we are in. And you saw the structure of the market. That there are many more other competitors and the next big three, and that discount competition in the markets differs a lot. And also Food Lion is a nice example against a high level of discount, 24 quarters of comp sales plus.
And Whole Foods, there just isn't enough Whole Foods in our market to make a huge amount of difference. But where we haven't really seen a big impact in terms of the difference in the competitive set, Whole Foods, pre-Amazon and post-Amazon. It's not a big impact in terms of our relative competitiveness. There's other challenges in our markets. That's not one of the big challenges. Not to say it won't become a bigger challenge, but today it's not been one of the biggest challenges that we've seen.
Mm-hmm. We have seen with Whole Foods and Amazon, the whole Prime, if you go in, if you shop the stores or whatever, if you're a Prime member, there's a lot of discounts and things like that they're doing. So they're starting to build some integrated ideas, but it hasn't been profound yet. And so while we have Whole Foods and we have Walmart through all of our trade areas, the density in the north is lighter for Walmart. Now we have a fair number of Whole Foods in the north though that we compete with today.
Good color, thank you.
Yep, so afternoon, it's Andrew Gwynn from Exane. Two quick questions. So the first one, you mentioned quite a lot about sort of local being better. Why does the group own the Southern Eastern European businesses? What benefit does it bring to the broader group? And then the second question, you talk a lot about these 150 competitors. Is the pace of exit in those competitors accelerating, or is it sort of broadly about stable?
On the first question, I think we shared with you today on what is our driver for selecting markets, number one or two, in leadership, profitable growth, growth in general, and positive ROCEs matching our returning requirements. And all the markets where we are operating, those conditions are met. So it's in a good 7 billion of sales. In those markets with good returns, good growth levels, and we're number one or two in those markets. So we are a happy owner of those assets. The second question?
Second question, sorry, was?
Pace of exit.
Yeah, pace of exit down the East Coast, for example, certainly.
Yeah, I can talk about that. Yeah, so we've had we've got a lot of small operators, and the world's not getting easier. We have a very, very competitive business, as you all know, with all the questions you're asking and that sort of thing. So we have seen a fair number of people who have been departing, some small ones or some bigger ones who have had some issues that they've been dealing with. So we do think there will be a fair amount of opportunity looking forward for the potential to acquire and dense up inside of our markets. We do think that'll be true. I would say that we see more activity now than we've seen in a long, long time.
And don't forget, it's not only how to run your business in a very competitive space, but a lot of those players have to make investments also to match up technology developments as well. That means IT, and that means technology, you need your people, and those investments are getting bigger. So if you're a small independent, then it's not so easy to invest these type of monies. So it's not only competing in price and daily, but it's also the investments in technology to stay competitive.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you. Rob Joyce from Goldman Sachs. Couple from me. First one, just on the cost savings and the synergies for next year. Am I right in reading that as a $600 million cost saving plus $150 million incremental gross synergy that's going to be reinvested in the business? And if so, can you give us a comparable number for 2018? Second one is just in terms of the further investments you mentioned in online, you've got the further pricing to go into the Stop and Shop banners on a sort of scheduled basis. Should we think of that flat margin for 19 as a sort of reasonable number to think of going forward beyond that? Thank you.
I think on the cost savings, look, the cost savings also will be reinvested in our business in terms of pricing, in terms of quality. But it's also, we're seeing some labor inflation significantly ahead of shelf price inflation. And so some of the cost savings you see in labor, for example, will be eaten up with that. So, but that is exactly the number that you should be thinking of. It's a similar number to, I couldn't pull the number out for 18, but I'd say it's probably a very similar number, with the difference being more synergy, less save for our customer, if you see, going the other way around. So I would think about it like that. In terms of margins going forward, I think we've been very clear and very transparent on guidance for 19. I'm not going to get into longer term guidance. I mean, we've talked about our business model, but we've been very clear on guidance, and we're not normally at this stage giving clear guidance, as clear for 19 in terms of both margin and EPS guidance, as well as CapEx and free cash flow. So I think we've gone as far as we want to go in terms of the guidance.
A lot of guidance for next year, yeah.
Beyond 19, you know, as I said, we don't want to get into specific guidance beyond 19 in terms of margins. That would be counterintuitive.
Yes, please, go ahead. Here in the middle.
It's Dusan from Berenberg. Thanks for taking my question. In the context of what Rob just asked, if your cost savings in 2018 is going to be similar this year, and then on top of that, we have the investments in e-commerce, Stop and Shop pricing, cost inflation, the headwinds you have mentioned, is it implicit in your guidance that some of these headwinds will be offset by the sales uplift that you expect to achieve from these initiatives? And if what, then to what extent does your 2019 guidance rely on that?
Well, the 2019 guidance is clear in terms of we'll deliver margins in line with 2018. And what we tried to demonstrate today is we deliver on what we commit to, and that's important. And that's perhaps one of the reasons we don't throw out massive numbers for media monetization. We're clear that we want to commit and deliver against what we talk about. So flat guidance, flat margins for 2019. In terms of the mix of the P&L, how do we get to flat in terms of sales development? I can't get into the detail of that. Of course, the whole strategy is that we want to get an improvement in our overall sales performance. So you will see some improvement in sales. And of course, we are investing in Stop and Shop. We're investing in e-commerce. But it's a mixture of inflation, It's a mixture of the cost savings, the synergy delivery, which we'll be absorbing as part of our initiatives in 2019. And it's a mixture of all of those that lead to the guidance that we will commit to holding margins flat in 2019, which I think is the right approach to take as we look at the current marketplace.
And again, that is a group margin, because brands by brands, it will be a mixed different type of set of the P&L in itself, what you invest in IT and technology and other OPEX, let's say, or what you can get cost savings out. So it's a group margin for 2019 we gave you as a guidance.
Can you just ask a quick, very quick follow-up? If we get to a, because the other aspect of the guidance is accelerating comps in the US. If we get to a point in 2019 where one works against the other, which one takes priority?
There's no, I'm not going to answer the prioritization like that, because it just gets written up in silly ways. I mean, we have been able over over the last 3 years, 2 years, and we've demonstrated it with the numbers, the market share numbers, the volume growth numbers, to deliver in the last 3 years margin improvements, market share improvements, and strong free cash flows. And we'll continue to aim to deliver in the way that we guide today. And I think that idea of it, does one take precedent over the other? No, we take a balanced approach. And that's why we decided in 2019 it wouldn't be appropriate to continue to push the synergies through into margin expansion in 2019. It just wouldn't be appropriate in 2019.
At the moment, in November 2018, a flat margin 2019, that's the guidance where you have to work with, and it's just up to us to deliver as reliable as we delivered a couple of numbers more in the last 2 years.
But we also, and I just to add to it, we also understand that you won't hold flat margins if you're not gaining volume over time. You know, you won't maintain margins if your volume is declining. So that wheel, the business model that we talk about, is critically important to everything we do.
But talking about growth, I think we've talked quite a lot about growth today, Jeff.
Sure.
It's a part of the plan anyhow, to make sure that the wheel spins.
Thank you.
And we get top line growth. Okay.
Well, let's now come across here. Sorry to...
Thank you. Maxime Allais from Deutsche Bank. I had three questions remaining. The first one is with regard to omni-channel that you've been discussing, and notably the uniformization of the digital platform and also of the loyalty program among the, well, across the different banners. Can you maybe give us a bit of color with regard to the time frame you expect for the rollout of, well, this uniformization, and when it's going to be ready and up and running? The second is with regard to your expansion plan, organic expansion plan, if you could share through the different banner what kind of expansion you target in the coming years. And the last one is with regard to your EPS target for 2019, high single digits. If you strip out the share buyback program, we get to, well, a low single digit type of number. You mentioned that you expect accelerating sales growth and a flat margin. Well, it seemed on the back of that this guidance is rather cautious. So is there anything that will hold back on the EPS growth in 2019, or is it rather caution on your side?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's a book of questions. Let's go for the first one, talking about the harmonization of the platform to have to use scale in order to service the brands. Maybe, Wouter, you can say a few things about, if you look at about a Bol, AHA, Albert Heijn, and the last type of platform for the Benelux, how do you see this evolving?
Well, the situation in Europe is slightly different than in the US. I think if you look at the maturity level of the different brands, that is different. And I think in the US, what JJ was talking about, he basically collected a lot of initiatives that were going on in the different brands into a center of excellence, which I think is a very good approach. In Europe, the Netherlands is by far, far ahead versus the other brands. So what we do is we build scalable capabilities, which we share with the brands. And the good news is I'm also responsible for that, so that's very easy. So I can work very closely with the Delhaize partners to see what they implement, but we also do it in Central Eastern Europe. So we don't need to build a kind of a platform as Peapod. I think we can use a more agile approach, where the people for instance, at aha.nl develop certain things that I've showed you today, and we can export them easily. We have a very close IT community under my leadership, where we actually do share these kind of activities, and they're also connected with the IT company, the IT folks from the US. So that's the best way to do it. And for us so far, that works really well. And as you've seen, we have already developed a lot of things, and we are keep on developing, and we share them as we go.
JJ, you gave already some indication on your platform, the People Digital Labs platform, yep. Maybe a little bit more color there.
Yep. So the integrated platform that we plan on launching across the US happens in multiple phases. As I talked about earlier, we're in pilot phase now with tests already running. I won't get specific exact dates, but just know that starting in Q1, we'll have the first series of releases there, and then we'll continue those releases throughout all of next year. The reason why the phased approach is because we need capabilities to get to click and collect first across the U.S., and then we'll scale those capabilities. What we didn't talk a lot about today is we'll also be launching a new loyalty scheme across the U.S. business, across some of our legacy AUSA businesses, and that too will launch next year. Those are the phases that we have planned for today. There's obviously more phases that you'll continue to iterate on. I think probably the biggest benefit that we have is because we own the technology, we don't have to wait all to one time for it to be done to launch it. We can add new releases and new functionality throughout the year, and that's how we'll plan to roll it out in the coming years.
I think on the expansion, we're not really going to get into specific targets for specific regions in terms of the growth, but clearly the strategy is about driving growth. On earnings per share, you know, we've given guidance on earnings per share. Yes, the buyback helps that, but obviously we like to see earnings per share growth, organic growth coming from our operating improvements. Is it cautious? Well, we like, I think, to deliver against our expectations. So, you know.
And the other thing on the expansion, I think you heard us saying the CapEx levels for next year. You talked about other great local brands. You talked about the formats. You talked about where we would like to grow and deepen footprints. So it will not come as a surprise how we grow organically within our brands, and where's an opportunity to grow faster, to gain share, to deepen our footprints, we will do so. And we have a lot of brands who do this in a very strong way.
I think it's important just to make a note that when JJ was talking about the loyalty programs, we're not going to have one ubiquitous loyalty program across the brands of Hold Delays USA. Each of our brands actually has the right and the autonomy to have the loyalty program that they think is correct for their communities, and we will integrate those against the design sets of those loyalty programs on this kind of base platform. So the Hannaford All Digital program that was just released is very different than what Meg has down at Food Lion for Shop and Earn. They're very different programs. And there's a new program that's being designed and will be eligible for the Giant Martin's, Giant Landover, and Stop and Shop if they choose to use it. It's a completely different design. It's all digital. It's really cool, and we're going to release that next year. But the brand presidents and their teams will choose whether or not they want to use that or if they want to do something else.
But the knowledge and the competence on loyalty systems in itself is
all
with JJ.
Everything's been moved.
So
our teams have been transferred.
Competence center loyalty is with JJ, but yeah. The brands can customize their loyalty programs as they feel needed for their customer base.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, let's take one more, should we?
I You have other interviews lined up.
No, we could have.
Thanks very much.
It's going
to be quick. Borja, JP Morgan. You guys have alluded to the successful Food Lion turnaround during the presentation. But in a way, it was specific, driven by improving sales densities and an increasing basket within this from a very low base, if that's fair. On the other hand, Stop and Shop sales densities are already very high. So how do we think about this? What's the main opportunity or driver? Is it a mix and basket opportunity? Is it a traffic opportunity or some sort of a different opportunity?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things I would say about that. It's a great question. And yep. So when we look at where Food Lion was, and I don't know how many of you were covering Food Lion at that time or were familiar with it, it was a very damaged brand. It was in very bad shape. And so the work that was done to restore that brand was truly remarkable work that Meg and her team did. in order to rebuild that brand. And so the point of that was is that we really do have a very disciplined and knowledgeable way to look at how do you reposition brands in a marketplace, and how do you actually build the brand promise out in such a way that you can connect with consumers the way that, that she wants to be connected with, and in a way that really helps you pull out the very best possibilities for that brand's future. And this is what we believe also, and it doesn't matter whether, we'll use Stop and Shop as an example. Stop and Shop has number one share in many markets, and it has a lot of customers, 7 million a week, that come into those stores. But there's a lot of things that we don't get from those customers that come into the stores. And when we also look at the food out of home and that type of thing, we are underpenetrated in those areas too. So even if we got fair share of wallet from our consumers in those areas, as we think about fresh and so on, just fresh, not center store, we would see pretty good sales growth. And then as we look at reconfiguring these customer-centric assortments in center store and linking that with our omni-channel, we think we have a really strong opportunity to really have a whole nother push. And we're in a market that really is still pretty fragmented in terms of what we operate in. So even if you go out on Long Island, for example, where the next market is, there's a lot of operators there. And so as we look at this, it's an opportunity for us, we think, to be able to come forward in a way that she really will appreciate and gives us an opportunity to get more of the share of wallet. And what Mark's seeing early here is we're getting more customer count too.
Okay, and Ken.
All right, thank you very much. And first of all, thank you very much for joining us today. So this concludes the Capital Markets Day and the webcast. A few practical points. There's lunch being served outside in the meals room to your left for those who stay here. For the store tours, please take a bagged lunch just outside the room. The bus is parked at Lexington, so around the corner at the main entrance of the city building. We will leave at 12:30 sharp, and we're all in one bus. And there is a small group that will be taken after the last store up to JFK, but I'll explain that along the way. So all in one bus, and again, there is an option to not to go back to the hotel, which the bus will do, but to be dropped off at JFK. So that's it. Again, thanks very much.
Thank you all very much for coming.